This is a Shift Podcast Network production.
Welcome back to another episode of The Last One to See. Kate, how are you doing?
I am not too bad. I am very excited to be going into a very particular 90s time warp, I feel. I feel like it's going to be going into a safe space for us.
Timing-wise, we are in a season of record stuff. I was attending Record Store Day the other week and was queuing up as usual at 4 a.m. outside my favourite record store in Dublin, Spin Dizzy, and managed to nail down all of the records that I wanted to get. So My obsession continues.
And speaking of that obsession, what film are we going to be discussing today, and with whomst?
We are going to be doing Empire Records with a DJ buddy of mine, Graham Smith. So he is a voice you might hear on RTE, and he regularly DJs around Dublin and has a couple of music festival appearances coming this summer. So it was a fun one, I have to say. Very looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, I think it was one of those guests where, and I know it's obviously a terrible stereotype, but given what Graham does for a living, when he said he hadn't seen this film, we were like, great.
Yeah.
You know, because I think there is an awful lot in that. And the feeling of like something that you, at the heart of this show is the feeling of something you should have seen. And sometimes it's a Titanic or an Avatar, or sometimes it's people in my life keep talking about this film. And I'm almost too embarrassed to say I haven't watched it at this point. And also, first time I've met Graham, which is exciting for me because I've heard so much about him from you.
I know. Yeah. Long time I think you may have seen him at a distance.
Yes. I feel I've been at some of your DJing events where I've seen you guys doing your fine work, but first time we'd actually, and we also had the absolutely staggering coincidence that both our parents were at a tennis tournament in Monaco. And I cannot tell you how unlikely it is that my parents would be there. So yeah, it was one of those, like, talk about odds of one in a billion sort of situation that our podcast guest's family would also be doing something that sounds suspiciously affluent.
So will we jump straight in?
Yeah, let's go.
So we are joined by, well, I say we, I am joined by Graham Smith, because unfortunately Kate couldn't make this recording due to a recording of her own in her job that she does running late. So Graham, welcome.
Thank you, David. I only saw you a couple of days ago, so this is interesting.
I know, yeah. So, like, I should clarify that this podcast guest is in fact a friend of mine. I've known Graham for, aging ourselves. What is it?
Five?
Coming on five years. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And music was what brought us together.
Indeed.
Originally. Started Dublin Record Club with Ed, and Graham showed up on day one and became a fellow founding member, essentially.
Slotted myself in there.
Yeah. Well, no, in fairness, we needed your talent. So we were very, very glad to have you involved.
Thank you.
Yeah. So it kind of seems appropriate then that the movie you've chosen is
Empire Records.
Yes. So what brought you to this film? Like, why did you pick this as your one for the last one to see?
Well, David, I actually think it was you.
Yeah. Well, in conjunction with someone else, for sure.
Yeah. So I think we were having a conversation. I can't remember exactly what it was. Me, you, and my girlfriend Sarah were having a chat, and then somehow Empire Records came up.
Well, actually, so I know, so I'll backpedal and fill in this blank for you, because it was when you were doing the first night of the Kip out in Dunleary, and that was actually my first time meeting Sarah.
Yeah.
And I mentioned to her about the podcast idea, and she was like, oh my God, that's great. I think Graham should do Empire Records on it, because she had like strong opinions about the fact that you hadn't seen this film, it seemed.
Well, no, a strong opinion is one way to say it. But what she said was, how do you have your personality and you haven't seen this film?
Yeah. Which I get what she's coming from here. Like, it's so like, what do you know about it aside from it allegedly having some correlation with who you are?
Yeah, I know next to nothing, or at least I didn't know anything about it until, well, that was a big giveaway. And then what you said as well about me loving music about 2 minutes ago has also given me a clue.
So it's those type of records.
Yeah. I was thinking Empire, okay, like Ottoman Empire, Roman Empire, maybe it's like historic records, that could possibly be it. I'm not hugely into that, although I do appreciate it.
A filing cabinet full of classical study stories.
Yeah. So then I thought, okay, records. like it's most likely going to be something to do with music, possibly a label. I don't really know. So I wasn't going to look it up on Google, but I thought, okay, I'm not going to actually search for it on Google, but I am going to type it into Google and see what comes up. So it's actually not that great. I thought it would give me more clues.
Yeah.
The main ones that gave me a slight little clue are Empire Records album songs, Empire Records music, Empire Records streaming, Empire Records vinyl. So I was thinking, okay, the soundtrack is obviously really good, or there's something to do with music that's really good here.
Excellent. Okay. So this is literally just like the autocomplete on Google. You didn't even click search. These are the finish the searches type ones. Yeah.
Exactly. And I can't, because my phone has put the search so small, I can't even see what the cover of it is. It's blue and that's all I know.
Okay.
So I can't really see anything. The only other things which I thought, okay, I wonder what that is about. It says Empire Records Andre.
Okay.
And I was thinking, Andre, maybe it's a character. Maybe Andre 3000 did
a little cameo.
A prime acting role when he was starting Outkast. And then it says filming location, which is also interesting. But that is it. It doesn't. The rest are like online watch cast, all the boring kind of autocomplete questions.
Anything that just goes with a movie, yeah. Cool. Okay. So that's still quite open in that respect. So if you were to, like, just literally based on the title alone, come up with a plot that you think this movie's about, what would it be?
I think it is about a record label in a Clerks style way. So it's all these really interesting characters who are possibly in the record label or in a record shop. And they're all just, it's just about their conversations. I don't think much happens in it. But I think the music is really good. I'd say there's a lot of quotes that are quite memorable. That's just the vibe I'm getting.
Cool. Okay.
From nothing.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, like the cast of characters, you don't know anyone who's in the movie.
Absolutely no one. No.
Okay.
The reason I said I love Clerks and I love films where nothing happens and they just use, it's really cheap. They use one or two locations. There's not a lot going on and it's all just based on dialogue. I love those films so much that I'm thinking it could be that way because my girlfriend said, how have you not seen this film?
Obviously, I don't want to go like, you know, ruining your potential like career in filmmaking, but you did talk to me recently about your own idea for one of these real like observational moments of life films, didn't you?
I did, yes. Yeah. So in Ringsend in Dublin, there's a roundabout beside the docks, and on this roundabout is a little cafe called Deke's Diner, and it's where all the shipyard workers go, all the truckers go for their breakfast rolls in the morning and whatever they're getting for lunch. And the people that go in there have amazing stories. It's kind of like a Roddy Doyle novel come to life. So I would love to make a film, if anyone wants to finance it, about that in a Clerk style.
Oh, like, I swear, like, we do have listeners who are involved in the Irish film industry in some ways. So, like, just consider
actually,
this.
Edit that out because someone will steal it.
Oh, no, we've got the copyright on it. Like, it's here, like, proof of your idea at a timestamp.
I have the script.
Yeah. We'll get working on it fast. So then the last question I have about the content of the movie.
Yeah.
Is, you mentioned obviously that you think there's going to be some like good songs on it and good soundtrack. Mm-hmm. There is a track by an Irish band on it. I'm guessing you don't know who.
On the soundtrack in 95.
Yeah.
Interesting. I wonder how relevant it is to me because I work in radio and a lot of former rock stars work in radio. Yeah.
So, one of your mates down the hallway.
Like, it literally could be someone from down the hallway who is on the soundtrack.
But yeah, so if you're to think of like Irish bands from the mid-90s who would appear on, like, obviously an American movie soundtrack, you'd need to have a bit of clout to kind of get up there. Who do you think might be on it?
I'm going to go with two guesses.
Okay.
One is the Cranberries.
Okay.
And two is Curb Dog.
Okay.
And the reason I'm choosing Curb Dog is, first, of all, because Cormac Battle is my mate and I work with him 5 days a week, which would be hilarious if he's on this film. And second of all, is it goes back again to Sarah saying, how have you not seen this? But they were quite big and they were quite grungy. Mm-hmm. And if this is in any way grungy, they could possibly be in there.
Okay, good. Well, like, I think it kind of, if you do get it wrong, one of those has to be in your Roundabout movie as a choice then. It's kind of like
most
the price
definitely.
You have to pay. You have to add it to your own soundtrack.
Fine.
Signed. And then one of the last things I'll bring up is that there are two versions of the film. This has happened before, and actually happened before with music-related films that we've done on the podcast. So in 2003, they put out a DVD called Empire Records Remix Special Fan Edition. So that adds 17 minutes of like deleted scenes and some extended scenes of stuff that's in there. I was looking it up. I actually have only seen the original version, not the remix one. And it seems that they're not essential kind of content. Like, it's more just like little Easter eggs and nuggets for super fans of the film. But the original is bang on 90 minutes, which is like a point of pride in this podcast of just we love a good 90-minuter. It's like, you don't need these 3-hour epics. It's like 90 minutes. Done and dusted. Well, dream.
You've already done James Cameron twice or three times.
We don't need another one. So we could get 2 Empire Records for a James Cameron. It's a very good deal.
I don't know if I'll watch it twice, but if I do, the first time I'll let it wash over me and the second time I'll take notes.
It was wash over because Titanic is still in your head there.
Yeah. Damn you, James Cameron.
Lovely. So do you have like a viewing plan for watching your movie? I know when we were talking to Andy in the last episode, he had a very kind of romantic idea for his Casablanca viewing. And for this one, are you getting in the mood for your movie related stuff?
I just text Sarah and I said, I'm going to watch it this weekend. Do you want to watch it on Sunday night? And she just said, yeah.
Excellent.
That's it.
Strong plan. Well, you know, the person who kind of got the ball rolling on all this, the fact that you're seeing it with her, I'm very excited.
Yeah. I'm not going to fly to Morocco to watch the film like Andy probably did.
you have to research, where is this Empire Records you speak of? brilliant. So I suppose we can probably wrap up on that, keep it fairly quick, and then save our big chat for when Kate will be joining us in studio.
Perfect.
I'm very excited for you to watch this one. It's been, well, like, I've been dying actually even just to revisit it myself. So I'll save my chat with you once I do watch it again until we get back in studio, but looking forward to it. That's it for the preamble. So here is your courtesy warning that we're about to get into spoiler territory.
I'm back and we are here. We are in studio. I'm very sad that I missed the opportunity to do the intro from the Premier Inn in Heathrow.
Oh, the glam.
I think it would have been our most glamorous dial-in yet. Yeah. I don't think we've done better than that, but unfortunately I was on a shoot that ran long, but Graham was left in the very capable hands of David.
Yeah, first time solo effort on the pod here, but we did well. I think given it's a seasoned radio host that I was joined by...
It was fantastic. Okay. It was a great experience, but I did miss Kate.
It's true. We've only just met and I think we're
already missing each other.
Yeah, it's true. He's seen photos of the cat. I mean...
a life bond has been made. It's fully true. On that.
Mainly with Monty rather than me, but hey, but I am the conduit to Monty. So I obviously missed the intro. One of the things I wanted to ask you guys before we start this off, I have not had the pleasure. Have either of you been record store employees? Record enthusiasts? Yes.
No, I don't think I have ever formally worked in retail.
Ever?
Ever. Unless you count charity shop for a week in transition year.
How did you only do it for a week?
It was like a work placement, but had to be community themed.
Yeah, we did that for a whole year every Thursday, and mine was in an Ulf. Some people were in charity shops and they used to give out about how boring it was. I was one of the people who was in Ulf Hugs Home when people kept dying.
Lovely.
Yeah, which is obviously the nature of the beast, but at the age of 16, you're like, well, I'm being very aggressively confronted with mortality here.
Yeah,
so I'm sorry that you find your charity shop work boring.
Yeah. No, but, and Graham, you never did the
retail thing?
World.
Oh, I did.
Oh, you did?
Oh, not the record store thing.
Okay.
I worked in a cafe. I worked
in a shop called Corner of Paradise in California, which was a bike shop on one side and an ice cream shop on the other.
Really thought you were going to say sex shop.
I wish it was a sex shop, but that is the extent of my retail experience. No records. No.
Yeah, I worked in a photo shop, like developing photos and stuff, which on one level would be records shop adjacent in some ways, but also it was just me on my own all of the time.
Is that also because, like, if you tell a Gen Z kid about it, they kind of go like, a watch shop?
Yeah, exactly. And like, I could print photos and stuff, but like with the big machines, I've never done the cool darkroom situation. Business, which I think would have also been a very, very slow way to develop the hundreds of photos that you were. So I think that would have been a problem. I worked in Abercrombie and Fitch also.
You did not, nice. Did
you? I think you know this.
I definitely do not know this.
He's looking at me. So I did my J1 summer in Chicago, and I was working in a designer consigners, which is basically like a fancy secondhand shop. And the owner was slightly odd and kept talking about my butt. She was a woman. So I went in, I was in Abercrombie and Fitch because I was picking up some bits for my sister who would have been, God, like, how old is I? 21. So she would have been 15 at the time. So obviously it was very,
it was the thing.
And they were like, do you want to work here? And I was like, okay. So for a while I had two jobs, and then the very idiosyncratic designer consigners hours started getting shorter. But I was also taught how to run the back room by an angry black lesbian whose name I think was Nisha. And he was clearly the only person who worked there with like any modicum of sense. Like, one guy found out I was from Ireland and asked me, did I commute? I was like, yes, I fly 8 hours a day to sell men's pants. So then she promptly took like all the holidays that she had saved up. So then I was just like running the back room of this entire shop. And I basically had a full-time job on my J1 summer. And then like the employee discount for Abercrombie, which was quite useful. But I also didn't have to be like, hello, welcome to Abercrombie. Would you like to see our jean wall or whatever the hell?
We need to do a film about this.
Yeah, definitely. And so wait, sorry, was this the same summer? Did you not work in a like a restaurant or a boat club or some?
No, you're confusing me with somebody else. I did the, because I think that's another J1 rite of passage where you're like a bar back or something.
Or I feel so, someone may have mentioned it on a previous episode of the podcast of working in a bar in Chicago on a J1, but yours was Abercrombie.
Yes, well, my follow-up is a couple of years, no, maybe it was the next year, we were visiting a friend of mine who's doing Erasmus in Sweden. And we met up with a friend of a friend who was a rather acerbic gay gentleman. And it came up in passing that I'd worked at Abercrombie. And he looked me up and down and said, people who work in Abercrombie are like supermodels and you're not.
Oh, nice.
My gosh.
I was like, well, thank you. I was about to say his name. Well,
Burnham, slay
him. It's a very generic man name.
No libels here.
I was just like, well, also it's like, tell me something I don't know, kid. Like, this is not really, this is not wounding me to my core. But I was also like, we have literally just met. You've given out to us for not doing Swedish lessons, which, I mean, David, not to besmirch, because you are Swedishing your way through Duolingo. Yeah. But yeah, and then you've also been like, you are too fat and ugly to be working in Abercrombie. Yeah,
not a great start to.
So, we haven't remained close.
No. Well, speaking of great starts, so will we start into the plot of the movie? Graham, do you want to kick off? What's going on in this movie?
What is plot?
I don't know if they thought of what the plot was for this film. So it's basically, it starts with a guy who's employed in a record store. He's closing up for the night and it's his job to put the takings into the safe, which is $9,000, which is a lot for a record store per day.
In cash.
And
no credit cards here.
For an indie, quote unquote, record store. I'm like, lads, come on now. Yeah. But anyway, he takes the $9,000 and obviously he doesn't put it in the safe. He goes to Atlantic City, throws it on roulette, loses it. Or craps, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's craps in the end.
Because there's a scene where he's going through the casino and like he has all the luck in and he says black 22 and that's what it lands on as he's going past. So we see a roulette wheel.
Yeah.
But then and it's probably worth mentioning that the reason he has decided to take all of this money and gamble on it with Atlantic City is he's working in a very cool, as you said, independent record store, but he finds plans to make it into a music town, which I assume is a sort of HMV golden disc.
Like record chain.
Situation.
Multinational moment.
Yeah, so he has decided to go to Atlantic City to like earn enough money to stop this happening.
Yeah.
Is my understanding of where his brain is going at this point.
So seems to be, yeah.
he loses the money, obviously.
Yeah.
And then comes in the next day, tells his manager that he loses the money. The manager doesn't really do much. And that's kind of where the plot ends for me. until the end of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it there are a series of vignettes that happen after that point.
Yeah, it's more character, like the kind of what is going on with the character at that moment in time in their life.
Yeah.
Rather than any more plot.
Yeah, because you have like that's basically all the Atlantic City trip all pretty much happens like in a sort of pre-credits sort of situation. That's your scaffolding for what's happening, and then you just start meeting more and more people who work in Empire Records. And then at the very end, in what is literally the last 50 minutes of the film, it's damn the man, save the Empire, let's put on a show. In the time-honored tradition of Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, it's like we're going to save, you know, the old barn, in this case, old barn of records.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's basically it.
And then pays the owner $9,000 for the whole shop.
We're led cool. to believe.
Yeah. The day's taking. I'll take it.
One day's taking.
I think it's more paying him back his $9,000 with the understanding that he will also be buying the shop, is my understanding of what's happening.
After the 89 minutes that I saw, I was like, it actually wouldn't be unreasonable for him to just accept this $9,000.
Yeah. Sure.
He hates them all so much. And then I suppose the other thing that's running through it is you have the visit of Say No More, Mon Amour of Rex Manning. Mm-hmm. So this is this, and it's interesting that I think it's 8th of April is now Rex Manning Day.
Yeah.
Which has become, this film has become a cult thing, this has become a cult thing, but 8th of April was the day Kurt Cobain died.
Yeah.
As well. So I think there is this idea of what is the antithesis of grunge. But he's also like, this man is not from the 90s. Is he from the 80s? Is he from the 70s? He's a sort of man out of time who looks like a sort of circus ringmaster, pirate sort of thing.
Yeah. Definitely not someone that teenagers would find cool.
Yeah.
That's what I don't understand. They're all head bopping to metal and rock and indie, and they're talking about, oh, how cool Axl Rose is, who's also out of time because he wouldn't be cool by 95. Mm. But even if they are still into Axl Rose and they're like, cool, we like Use Your Illusion and we're still on the Axl boat, it's like, how can you like Rex Manning and also like Axl Rose?
But I think they don't, because they obviously tell him how shit it is. And like the whole thing is, you know, we mustn't fight, not today, not on Rex Manning Day.
Yeah.
But I think there is an element, obviously, like, that like you can ironically like it's sort of Living La Vida Loca, and whomst among us would not dance to that. Yeah, but I think obviously he's been booked by Mitch, the owner, as opposed to Joe, the manager, who is the dad figure who doesn't fire anybody bafflingly through the course of this film. Yeah, so he's been booked by him to come in when he's doing it, and he's got a new album. So he's someone who has been very successful in a... It's a sort of Duran Duran. I don't know what's going on. There's lots of writhing on a bed in the music video. And apparently that music video, they only needed like 17 seconds of it, and the guy who shot it just gave them like a 4-minute edit, and you can watch the entire...
The whole thing.
The entire thing as like a... whatever the equivalent of a DVD extra is.
Amazing. He gave me Shooter McGavin vibes from Happy Gilmore.
Oh, I haven't seen Happy Gilmore in ages. That
he's just a smug golfer guy who's better than everyone else.
Yeah, he is the lead in Grease 2.
Yes.
And had done a lot of, I think, like EastEnders, Emmerdale situation. But I think he has also lent aggressively into the whole Rex Manning thing.
Yeah.
Because he now has a day dedicated.
Yeah, it would make sense.
It's mine.
Yes.
So it's where will we, but we'll circle back to a little bit earlier in the film, I think. In terms of the whole breaking the fourth wall stuff, I was getting hints of like The Office and Parks and Rec and those kind of stuff, and like the workplace setting as well. It was a kind of like before its time sitcom, and I think like it's relevant because the whole movie feels like it is kind of like selections from a TV series.
Like it is kind of like it is a workplace gentle comedy. Mm-hmm. And also the thing I find quite interesting is like he kind of stops doing that. Like again, it sort of happens for the entirety of the opening sequence, and then it doesn't really happen again.
Like a handful of moments.
Yeah.
Through it. Like,
and then you have the one slightly bizarre sequence of Mark, who is like, I can't decide if he is just like a lunatic or if he's a danger. Like he is quite an odd character, and he's eating what are like hash brownies or pop brownies, but they can't tell us that.
Yeah.
And he starts imagining himself in the music video he's watching.
Of Gwar as well.
And like whatever plot there may be in this film, and there are like threads of plot running through it in relationships and stuff. Mark truly exists as a man out of time. Like he is just completely like independent of the film until he does run onto a live news broadcast, invite everyone down for the big concert they're doing to damn the man and save the Empire.
He is the savior.
Yeah.
But he truly has nothing to do with anything else that's happening for the entire course of the film. He's having a great time. He seems very happy, mainly because he seems off his gourd for the entire movie.
Yeah. And that fourth wall thing, it reminds me of Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah. Mm.
That kind of vibe, as well as Friends. Because I was like, what else was released around then that's similar? And then I read the story about the studio took this script and then someone offered them Clueless and they were like, oh, we already have a teen script. Mm. And then Clueless made 50-odd million.
Yeah, they're the only studio passed on Clueless. Everyone else is like, give it to me now.
This grossed like 300 grand and then obviously...
But part of the reason that it grossed 300 grand was they had it initially to go to do like a big multi-screen opening and then they released it to 85 screens because they basically didn't really know what to do with it. And then it became a sleeper hit on initially VHS, and that kind of added to, I think that kind of goes with like the feel of it, because it's this idea of something that like is independent and unique and only you know about, but people were discovering it over and over again. Mm. And the cast were saying they didn't even realize how big it was until in the 2010s, like they put up a photo of five of them together and people went insane and they started going to some of the reunion screenings. So like this has all been a massive flop, like something they remember really fondly, as by the sounds of it, they had a great time, most of it, which probably can't be repeated because they're always a bit like, it was amazing. There's certain things we cannot talk about.
Yeah.
But they actually had no idea. My cousin showed me this in certainly, if not the late 90s, the early 2000s. Yeah. So I think it was one of those films like that I've known about now. And also like I did used to work in an indie radio station, and a lot of people did also used from there had worked in HMV and stuff as well. Mm. So I think it is something, because it definitely smacks of like the soundtrack is like people who worked in college radio in the States. I think I've been aware of it for a long time, but I find it quite funny that the cast weren't aware that they had this massive hit on their hands.
In terms of the VHS, for me it makes sense, because if something like Clueless came out, when I saw that I was like, this is actually a film and I would sit down and watch that again. With this, I feel like I would put it on a loop for the whole day because I want to be in that store, but I don't want to watch it as a film again, if you know what I mean.
You want the VR experience of the Empire Records.
So will we talk a little bit about the cast that you would be spending your time with in this store? Because basically, after they're opening up the store, this is when our ensemble is introduced. Mm-hmm. They're arriving one by one. Then we have the montage of them opening up. As a side note, this film fucking loves a montage.
Yeah.
There are very many of them. And I think that this may come from something that you guys were touching on about, like the whole plot thing, that this was absolutely changed in post-production. Apparently, three main characters were cut out. It was originally meant to be over 2 days as opposed to one. Mm-hmm. So there definitely is like a feeling, and some of it, I quite like the idea that there are some unfinished threads and some, and you're walking right into the middle of something.
Actually, you mentioned the characters cut out of it. Tobey Maguire is mentioned in the credits.
Sorry, where was he?
Doesn't appear in the movie at all, and doesn't even appear in the deleted scenes that they sent out back in later.
He auditioned. And then apparently he took some mushrooms and the director found him. And I think he auditioned. I think he was at the like workshop portion or whatever. Took some mushrooms and the director found him eating an enormous bowl of cereal and having an existential breakdown. So suggested that he went back to Hollywood and he said he was going to write a script, which he didn't. But then he ended up being in The Ice Storm 2 years later, and 8 years later was Spider-Man.
He turned it around from that
pretty well.
And in terms of the almost could have been, Angelina Jolie auditioned and they were thinking better for any of the female roles, but they were just like, she would have eaten everyone alive.
Yeah.
Do you know who I heard was also supposed to be in it? Was your man from Green Day.
Yeah, Billy Joel Armstrong. Yeah. The role of Burko, who's played by Coyote Shivers, who was at the time, which they did not know, Liv Tyler's stepdad.
Wait, go again?
So he was married to Liv Tyler's mother, Babe Buell. Liv Tyler's father is obviously famously in the lips department. Is your man.
Aerosmith.
Stephen Tyler.
Yeah, Stephen Tyler. I bet you call him Stephen Aerosmith.
Mr. Aerosmith?
Yeah. Coyote Shivers was subsequently married to her mother. Now, I do believe there's allegations that he was abusive and whatever, so just to mention that. But yeah, they didn't tell anybody because he was pretending that he was like the same age as these kids in their early 20s. Now, he was only like, I think, 10 or 12 years older than Liv, so it wasn't like he was like, hello, fellow kids, and in his 50s. Yeah. But then I think it came out that he was her stepdad, and also that he availed of the over 26 car insurance. So they figured that out. So he plays Burko, who is kind of the rocker guy with his arms out, who plays guitar. So you have in this film, you've got, I think like The female performances are more iconic, I think, A, because they're all quite famous. And this is like a lot of their first roles. Like Renee Zellweger was going out with the guy who plays Lucas at the time and who had been in Dazed and Confused. And he encouraged her to audition for this and she got the role. Liv Tyler was mainly known from all of the Aerosmith videos that her and Alicia Silverstone also had been in. And then you had Robin Tunney as well, but also like these women are going through it. The guys are all a bit weird or a little bit off center, whereas the women are all like slightly damaged or going through like major shit. So you have Liv Tyler, who plays Corey, who's a stereotypical good girl with a father who seems truly deranged, because he tell in the first 15 minutes there's only I'm trying to get this right, that there's only that there's 24 productive hours in a day, which there are clearly not, because you have to sleep and eat and, you know, shower.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then he also, she's doing her homework in the back in the back room, which is calculus. And she's like, I hate it, but my dad says I have to get an A. And then he sends like a flower basket to the store labeled to like the number one student in Harvard for whatever her graduating year will be in 4 years. So like to say this man is like whatever the equivalent is of a tiger mom. Kind of insane. So she is outward and she's going to Harvard or whatever and is outwardly a good girl, but is also popping speed like there's no tomorrow. And I cannot say I blame her.
She loves those candies. Yeah.
And then her best friend is Gina, played by Renee Zellweger, who is the slut with a heart of gold, I think is sort of what we're going through there. So you have the two of them.
It's funny that this is the real thing. And I think it's got a little bit better now, but it was really bad, I think, in the 90s of American actors like 10 years older than their age playing teenagers, because you've got Liv Tyler, Renée Zellweger, Robin Tunney. I think they're all supposed to be like similar or same-ish.
Yeah, I
age.
Think like late teens, maybe early 20s, like AJ, who is in love with Corey / Liv Tyler. And I mean, whomst among us could not be. He's paying rent and he's looking to go to art school. Mm. Whereas I think Liv Tyler is going to college like that September or whatever.
Like she was definitely
into Harvard,
I think,
only
like 17 or 18 when they filmed this. Yeah. And then Renee was 25 and who you've got Robin Tunney, I think was about 22. But yeah, Renee's character, I'm like, she's there was something about her that was like, you're definitely past this, the high school thing. I wasn't getting high school vibes at all.
You weren't convinced?
No, she didn't sell it to me. There was something that she was kind of like too hung up on high school preoccupations, but you'd just look at her and it's just like, oh no, you're definitely past that life.
Yeah.
I mean, like Berko's like 50, so there is that. But I think, again, he's meant to be that bit older. And one of the things I like about Robin Tunney as Debs or Sinead O'Rebellion, shock me with that deviant behaviour, is that her other main role that she's known as is in The Craft. And she's almost a stereotypical good girl in that, whereas here she's like kind of an antagonist in the as much as that any of them are. But the whole thing is it is a group of people and a moment in time, and this also seems to be an environment where you can literally shoot at somebody and be hired. So like,
that's what I found jarring, was the idea that someone had just tried to kill themselves, someone's addicted to speed, someone is probably engaging in underage sex, depending on her age. I don't know what age she's supposed to be in the film. And we have your man coming in with a gun. But it's like, I felt when Liv Tyler, when they reveal that, oh, you're addicted to speed, and she like screams and has this like insane screaming and shouting fit. And I'm like, what is going on? This is like extremely light.
Yeah.
And then it goes dark for about 10 seconds. And then it's like, oh, we're back to wacky again. Yeah. And I'm like, I can't flip that easily.
Yeah. Like some of the reactions to certain moments, ideas, concepts are so varying in terms of like the severity of, as you say, like the Liv Tyler speed breakdown.
Yeah.
And then like, as I said, like stuff like, oh, the store is gone and like someone attempted suicide is all just treated as like, oh yeah, we'll just get along with it.
Par for the course.
Yeah, it's just very
But
very
I think like
reaction.
One of the key lines in it is not damn the man save the empire, but is when Robin Tunney comes in, shaves her head in the store, which she did do for real, because she's like, it's the only way it's going to look good, and probably gave us all a very false idea as women as to how good we would look with a shaved head.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah, and she already, as you said, has attempted to cut her wrist with a...
Before she finishes it, I did enjoy her like one side shaved
sort of
and like
early
floppy.
Cara Delevingne undercut kind of situation. Yeah,
I kind of wish she had left it there, but
yeah, but no, she went for the whole thing. And then had tried to kill herself with a plastic Lady Bic razor, as she mentions. But they do, in fairness, immediately. AJ is like, "What is going on? Are you okay?" But Luca says to him, "It's okay. She's in the store." And I think that's the idea is nothing really bad can happen there. Mm. Paired with the other line, I think, is that Joe says, "I haven't fired anyone today. Why do you think I'd start with you?" Yeah. So it's all like it is. Almost, it is a space without consequence.
Yeah. And it had that feeling of like the likes of the Breakfast Club and other stuff where it's like you're in a kid's environment and the few adults you get to see are more side characters or like they're not like it's kid world.
Yeah. Joe's kind of like a father substitute.
Mm. But he nearly like say the prince or the whoever's running detention in Breakfast Club. It's kind of like the senior like touch point with grown up world.
Yeah.
But otherwise everything else is just outside the walls of
and Anthony LaPaglia has won an Emmy and a Tony, I think. So he's halfway to an EGOT from this.
Well, he wouldn't have won it forever. For that.
No, I don't think. I mean, I enjoy his drumming and his long hair. And then so we have our girls who are all dealing with pretty serious shit. Then we have our boys. We have Lucas who is the guy who goes to Atlantic City, but we learned that he was also fostered by Joe, I think is what they are also saying in it. And we have Mark, who again is an absolute spaceman, but that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
We have AJ, who is...
Babe.
Babe. I consider him a sort of sentient fringe, but if that's your type.
No, and like has kept it. Like I looked him up.
He's a handsome dude. He is
looking well. Yeah.
And his main thing is that he is, I don't even know if they say necessarily from the wrong side of the tracks, but from a lower socioeconomic status than Liv Tyler. He is in love with her. He wants to go to art school. He wants to tell her that he's in love with her by 1:37.
There is a line that he uses. It's like, do you know when he's on the roof and he's like thinking about all the ways that he wants to like declare his love to
how
her?
He would describe his love,
The line, "You make me feel like a bath," is now like the most romantic phrasing in the world in my books.
I think he improvised a lot of that. He just read, like, they had loads of it that he went on for a really long time.
I want to hear the cuts that they left out, like where he went with that one.
Poetry for David.
Fantastic.
And then we have Berko, Liv Tyler's stepfather. Liv Tyler's abusive stepdad, which is, it is truly mind-blowing, but it is a good, like, nugget about this film. He's one that, like... We don't really know what his deal is other than he is recognisably older than them and that him and Deb have been having some sort of relationship. Something happened and she says it has nothing to do with why she killed herself. But we don't really get any more information about them. We've Lucas, we've Mark, we've AJ, we've Berko, we've Eddie, who I think double jobs as a pizza boy and also does work in the... Initially, you're like, is this just a man who hangs around? But then he does come in and clock in as well. So I think that's pretty much like our full cast of characters. And then we have Rex Manning and his assistant Jane, played by the peerless Debbie Mazar, who's just, if you look at like any sort of thing from the 90s, she's sort of just there, like whether it be a club night in New York or an indie film, like she's one of those people who just sort of is like a thread through the whole decade.
Well, that's because I looked her up afterwards and I was like, oh my god, she's in everything. And I was like, no, it's your one from Beethoven. That's initially my thought,
because that, like, more recently she was on that show Younger. It was the one from the creator of Sex and the City and had like Hilary Duff and I can't remember the lead.
Is it Sutton?
Sutton Foster, yes. Yeah.
I was about to say Sutton Coldfield, which is a place in Birmingham. but I was quite clear. Yeah, she's Sutton Foster, who's a big Broadway.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I wouldn't have known her. I watched like the first couple of seasons of Looking, of Younger, and she was great in that. But it's like she was like best mates with Madonna as well.
And Chloe Svegney, and she is that girl. But she has very little. She is Rex Manning's assistant who leaves him in the middle of the shoot, and then in the middle of the shoot, in the middle of the
meet and greet.
Because he's a dick, and his music is terrible. but then comes back to offer to be the night manager / go on a date with Joe. So that she has very little to do. And then, of course, the other main character that we see throughout the day is Warren Beatty.
Yes.
Not the actual Warren Beatty, a shoplifter who gives his name as Warren Beatty. We never learn his actual name and they refer to him as Warren for the entire time. So he's there as waiting for the cops. And then they kick him out and then he comes back, as you say, with a gun. I think a measure of how this is kind of taken relatively lightly is that it's a pre-Columbine world and that it's also something that looks like it is from a Western rather than like an AR-15 or whatever.
Yeah, it's very antique-y looking gun for sure.
Yeah, but then they managed to talk him down, largely dead, by just being like, I'm not scared. If you're going to shoot me, just shoot me. I already tried to kill myself today. And then they offer him a job in the store and give him his name printed on the lanyard. That's the word that they wear, right? That they wear around their neck. So it is like, I think it is, it's a space and a time that doesn't exist anymore for us now. Mm. And I think we'd all look back at it really fondly because there isn't really real cultural, like, by real, I mean as in bricks and mortar cultural spaces in the same way that's, I think there are some, there is places on the internet, but I don't think there's a real space that you can go to in the same way.
That's the big thing for me is that, like, I hadn't seen this film before, obviously, and I was only 4 when it was released. So it just completely passed me by. And I saw this record store and I was like, this doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Where is this? Like, I want to be in this.
I only saw like an article this week that was talking about Dublin lacking the kind of third space kind of concept, and like that whole thing of
them
like
all into hotels and apartments.
Totally, and that like outside of home and work, that people were completely eroding. Like, and especially places that are non-transactional, where you don't have to like, you know, buy a coffee or pay admission or that kind of thing. Like, we don't have places like that where you can go and
like
hang out.
Even the listening boots and even still like it was.
Yeah, the dream.
Yeah, that you could like you could consume the music without actually buying it. Now you did buy it because they were making $9,000 of cash a day.
Yeah.
And like it was the age where you were buying loads of CDs, you were buying.
And that's not even on Rex Manning Day.
Yeah, exactly. That's just on that's pre-Rex Manning Day.
Rex Manning Eve.
Yeah, the eve of Rex Manning Day. Rex Manning Eve. Oh, that makes me so happy. But yeah, like there, so I think it makes you nostalgic for like a time that we didn't massively experience. Like, I used to go into Golden Discs and Tower Records and stuff, but I don't think it was quite the same.
I would like to find an employee of an Irish Golden Discs or Tower or even HMV from the 90s and ask where
Richie
McCormick, dance parties
come on down.
A common thing.
There is so much dancing in this store.
Can't complain. Yeah. I loved it.
I don't know if it's also like, you know, Americans are more prone to spontaneous outbursts of joy and violence, but like, yeah, that is one of my notes is there is so much dancing in this film.
That's what I don't understand as well is in a lot of films like this with teenagers in America, they have so much energy. I would never have ever had that energy. They're like doing backflips. They're like running around. They're jumping up and down. They're doing like parkour around the store.
You did see how much speed that Liv was taking.
Well, Liv is the most chilled of a lot of them.
Until she doesn't get what she wants. And then you have like a girl doing ballet who incidentally is the stepdaughter of the guy who plays Rex Manning and was just like visiting on set. And
there's a lot of family going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. And you also have where Mark kind of tries to kiss her while she has her eyes closed and she's dancing. And that's a moment where I was like, is Mark a danger? Because before I'm just like, what a space cadet. Whereas now I'm like, huh.
Yeah. He does not understand consent. Oh,
yeah,
no.
Exactly. Which actually, to be fair, the person who appears to understand consent is Rex Manning.
Yeah.
Because Liv Tyler's decided she's been in love with him since he's been in some show, All in the Family, which I think is basically a version of like Family Matters that she's been watching since she was a kid. And she has decided she wants to lose her virginity to this man, much to the approval of Gina, Renee Zellweger, who has gifted her with this sexy red bra that she iconically pairs with like white granny panties because she is still, like, she's kind of simulating adulthood and sexuality. She's sort of pretending it. And then when, like, he is like, you're a very sweet girl, no. And then he's like, are you sure? And then he's like, how old are you? And he's like, are you sure? So to be fair, the person who seems to be quite clear on consent is Rex Manning.
Yeah. Well, it's creepy when it's so age precarious checking. You know what I mean? That like, if she looked like she was mid-20s or later, would he have been as cautious as maybe my question there?
Yeah, but as soon as he basically agrees to any sort of unzips his fly and agrees to a sex act, she freaks out and runs away. And I think even with that pair, that kind of iconic pairing of the sexy red lace bra and her white panty, it's like she has no idea what she's doing.
Yeah.
Which is very sweet. But then afterwards she's having coffee with Gina, takes off the bra and gives it to her as one. I have to say also fair play to her. Like, I know she's wearing that iconic crop sweater and not a lot else, but like there's a lot going on there that she was able to take off the bra without any of her clothes. And Gina basically is like, oh, we'll find somebody else for you. And then Speed Freak Liv freaks out and basically is like, I don't want to be a slut like you, basically. Mm. So then Renee Zellweger promptly goes back to the store and has sex with Rex Manning in the check-in, the time, the clocking out room.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have, there's a lot of rooms as well. It's like there's a clocking out room, there's a chill out room, there's an office, there's many booths.
Yeah. Like, and again, like, so representative of the idea that like barely any record stores exist now in Dublin, like, let alone a two-story one.
That Virgin mega store on the Quays.
Mm. Yeah.
That closed down when I was pretty young, but that is what I envisioned it looked like inside.
The scale of
and
that,
actually, I think the thing that makes it work as I want to climb inside it is that it was a soundstage, but they built it for real. And I think you can feel that as well.
Oh,
it does feel
like
a very real space. Whereas
I fully would have believed that was like filmed on location.
CGI it or something.
Yeah.
It does feel like a set that you can climb inside.
Totally. Yeah.
Which, I mean, if they put that in some theme park, I would absolutely go to
Empire Records.
Yeah. Yeah, this is your immersive experience. Yeah, I just want to sit in the record store like it's the 90s. Thank you.
Sit in the booth. Yeah, and then you have like that random couple making out. I think it's a vibes piece, but there's loads of texture to it. Mm. But also it is kind of, I'm not even sure if it's of the time it's supposed to be. Like, I think when we look at it now, we're like, oh yeah, 90s. Yeah. But I think it's kind of a patchwork of stuff that isn't necessarily 100% representative of the time.
Patchwork seems like a good way to describe it.
Yeah, of the whole thing. But I think, yeah, it is one of those things where you're just like, I want to climb inside it because it is a space that feels safe. Mm. And it clearly does for all of them because it seems you can literally, you will survive being shot at. You will survive trying to kill yourself. You won't get fired if you steal money or have a screaming breakdown in the middle of the store or shag an aging pop star. Like there is nothing you can do that you'll be hurt here.
Yeah.
Except for the woman who's crying to the carpenters in the listening booth because someone's clearly hurt her quite badly.
We've all been there at some point. So if you were to pick out of the cast the character that you feel most closely represents yourself, who would you be in Empire Records?
Oh, wow. I'm going to say a much less annoying version of Lucas.
Okay. Why? What's the draw there? What do you feel connected?
I like that he's always asking questions and he's always kind of saying, well, you're saying this, but what about this?
Mm.
And he doesn't let anyone away with anything. And I feel like when everyone's kind of getting in on the dancing and they're all like, oh, this is cool. Like, we're just going to have a fake funeral for Deb. Everyone's standing around. He always has a different view, or he's doing something different to everyone else. So he's kind of the outsider.
But I think this is a relative, because they're like, why are you talking? He started kind of talking like a Buddhist or something. And they're like, what are you doing? Why are you talking?
That's what annoyed me.
But I think it sounds like it's a new invention, or it's a new thing since he's decided to like save the record store or whatever. Because I think Mark is kooky as, and that's sort of an established thing, whereas they all keep being like, what is wrong with you? Why are you being like this? And even that he's wearing like the black polo neck and stuff as well. It's some sort of like beatnik existentialist situation.
So he's become the savior overnight. Well, he tried to be, and now he's trying to
badly wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's also, I think he's also in Dazed and Confused as a long-haired stoner. You'd see him on the cover. I think he's wearing like one of those backwards, like not quite granddad hats, but the ones that they kind of, the shape of those Kangol hats.
Oh, yeah,
you know what I mean? So yeah, he was in that film already.
Okay.
So yeah, they're all, and then loads of them went on to, including Anthony LaPaglia, who plays Joe, who was in like about 10,000 episodes of what's it called? What's it called? Okay, so Without a Trace. Loads of the lads went on to be in crime shows, and the women went on to be movie stars.
Yeah.
Weird. I'm not surprised, though, that they're in TV, because it is very TV. Yeah.
I think they've all had, like, good careers, and that's what Roger Ebert slated this movie when it came out, but he did say, if the movie is a lost cause, it may at least showcase actors who have better things ahead of them, because I think they are all very like charming and engaging and believable as this like teen ensemble.
Yeah, yeah, like that for as chaotic as the movie can feel at times, it is really held together by great performances that like you kind of, you're getting constantly just like snippets or samples of scenes with them, but you kind of want it just to hold on some people more and like go deeper or that kind of thing, because they are
selling which I do it. Quite like, and I think some of it does come from like this ensemble cast that we're all like living together where there was nothing to do but like work and then go to the beach and by the sounds of it take copious amounts of drugs. So I think like you do get that feeling that you've kind of walked into this group of people that have underlying loves and resentments and relationships with each other as well.
Do you think it would have this longevity if all those actors didn't do what they did further in their careers?
It's a hard one to say because I think it does draw you in terms of like Baby Liv and Renee, but I think it is the feel of it that people do identify. And also, like, when it's the cult thing started in the 90s, like, Renee Zellweger hadn't won her Oscar for Judy. Mm. Yeah, we saw it.
Classic.
Yeah, as we did. Yeah, and then obviously everyone was in love with Liv Tyler, but I think, yeah, you're all... I mean, I'm still in love with Liv Tyler. I think I'll be in love with Liv Tyler till I die. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a hard one to say, but I think the cult status started before they were both as, like, mega famous as they are.
Superstars, yeah.
I'm trying to think if I've... Yeah, we've talked about the... talked about the almost has-beens of this. I think, like, one thing that remains that we haven't really touched on is the music. Mm. The 50 songs that are in this film, 16 of which, and a random collection of 16, it feels like, made it into the official soundtrack, which was released on Record Store Day in 2012 on vinyl, slightly before your Record Store Day.
Oh, no, that was the beginning, I believe, of my Record Store Day.
Do you have it?
No, unfortunately not, but...
Is that what's in the box?
No, well, wait and see.
When is music not playing in this film?
Never. Yeah. There's constantly just a hum in the background.
It must have cost a fortune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although it's funny, I was listening to You Are Good, did an episode about Empire Records a while back, and they mentioned for a movie that is so centered, like, thematically around music, music doesn't really play a huge amount, like, front and center. It is far more like the radio playing in the background. And you obviously have Rex Manning's song kind of showcased, but aside, and then there's a few song moments with certain scenes, like Romeo and Juliet gets played, and then
Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yeah. First song they ever played in MTV.
Did you catch which Irish artist it actually was in the
end? Well, I got it right.
You got it right. It was the Cranberries.
I was thinking about that time.
I think it's Liar. I think it's not like Zerlinger or one of the bigger ones.
What I was thinking about the music, because there is music, there's so much of it, and as you say, Kate, it would have been so expensive to get the rights to all of them. The cynic in me is like, is this just a corporate film that's like, okay, all you major labels... Tarantino is the big man on the scene now, and he's saying music is the most important thing about films. It ties everything together. You get loads of money out of the soundtracks. Let's put a load of our new signees on this thing, and they'll all be huge.
To be honest, I think it's kind of the opposite, because I think the soundtrack is full of songs that the people who wrote it loved when they were in college. I also think that, like, by the sounds of it, the studio had no clue what to do with this film when they were given it. The director, Alan Moyles, who'd done, I haven't seen it, but a film called Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater, which is all about pirate radio, and that would have been really successful, and a lot of the cast would have seen that, and it would have been very big for them. He was like, the studio are more of a cocaine mentality and we are more of a pot mentality, is how he put it, that I think they literally wanted to cut the shit out of it and they didn't really know what to do with it, hence only releasing it on the 85 screen. So I think if you wanted to make loads of money from selling a soundtrack, I think you would release your film in more than 85 cinema screens.
Yeah,
well, that's true. Yeah,
the soundtrack stuff on Wikipedia, they mentioned the Atlantic Records were supposed to kind of put out the soundtrack in, like, the original plans, but then they wanted to use a Gin Blossoms track and they were on A&M Records, so the whole soundtrack was given to A&M because of literally this one track that they wanted on it.
That makes sense.
So, is it all A&M artists?
Yeah, because it does feel like a fairly random 16 out of the 50. Mm. Like, certain things aren't on there. I will say, I do love that the version of Sugar High that they do.
It's so good.
In the Beatles style, on the Concert on the Roof, Renee Zellweger has said during her making up with Liv Tyler that, like, she's scared of everything and what she really wants to do is be a singer in a band. And then when she's on stage with Coyote Shivers, whose just name I'm just going to say for the rest of my life, Liv Tyler's stepdad, Coyote Shivers, he's no longer with her mother, so Liv Tyler's former stepdad. So he's like, take the lead for the mic and whatever. And, like, to be fair, Renee Zellweger can sing. Like, she was in Chicago or whatever, you know, so, like, we know now that she can. But yeah, and especially in the film, they have alternate lyrics because the actual lyrics are quite filthy. I think they're not on the soundtrack, but if you look for that song, like, you'll find whereas, like, there's all stuff like, they all said she's just another groupie slut, whereas that's replaced by something like a bowl of cherries or something.
Yeah, the soundtrack is what disappointed me most.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really interesting because so many people, it's very beloved.
I feel like it felt like a load of bands who were big on indies got signed to majors and then people were like, we don't want to mess with you anymore because now you're on a major label. Mm. So you're not big enough to be kind of like in the pop sphere of cool.
And cool producers.
And all that, you're not indie anymore, so we have no market for you. And from the point of view of on screen, They're talking about Axl Rose. They're talking about Alice in Chains, and they're not there.
Mm.
So, yeah, that kind of disappointed me.
Yeah.
But it does make it does feel like, and obviously everyone gets a veto, which we see being used. A lot of it feels like the type of music that employees would want to be listening to, which is not necessarily a la working in Abercrombie and Fitch when they're playing the same 10 songs over and over again. You think you're going to lose your mind.
Oh, you're not going to be playing Alice in Chains, though. In
Abercrombie and Fitch. No, probably not. They wouldn't let you. Although they did have an indie playlist and I once accidentally played it in the whole store. Well, I used to put it on in the back room for me so I wouldn't want to shoot myself. yeah, but that was fine. I didn't know until somebody came running in, but that was fine. At that point, I was the only person who knew how to work the stock system, so they couldn't fire me. Much like Empire Records, I was unfireable.
Yeah. I did enjoy Joe's drumming to AC/DC, though.
Yeah, You Want Blood, and then you have, again, another dance montage.
Yeah.
Where Lucas, I think, is doing a Mick Jagger impersonation, but it does just slightly look like he's having an episode.
Yeah. I loved that their CD changer thing in
the siren
that went off every time someone went to change.
I think that's you exercising your veto.
Yeah, but that, like, I would love if you remember, like, iPods at parties in like 15 years ago, where like there'd always be feet pulling out the fucking aux cable and like plugging their own shit. There, if you could get a cable that set off a siren every time someone unplugged, oh,
dream. 30 seconds into a song, they're plugging out. No,
fuck
siren.
So it sounds like you wanted to like this more than you actually liked it, and you want to be in it.
That sums it up pretty well. So the feeling I got from this was Breakfast Club, Clerks, in a record store. This is my dream.
Mm-hmm.
But it just didn't do that. I feel like if I wanted to watch a film like this, I'd watch Breakfast Club.
Mm.
It does have that wacky sense of humor. It's in a kid's world.
The tone's all over the place, I think it is.
Yeah.
Fair to say. Like, I do really like this film, mind you, but it's also like something that my cousin showed to me, possibly even on VHS, maybe DVD, when I was like 12, and I was like, this is what being an adult is like. Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spoiler, it's not. You will get fired if you sleep with somebody in the break room.
Now you say it, like, it's one of those movies that I think I was teens first time I watched it, and I think you idolize it and you can look up to it as this real, like, oh, that's what I wanted to be in the future. And then when you're an adult coming back to look at it, you're just kind of like, oh, you kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? I wonder what the tipping point is between, and it feels like it goes by so incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
Of you going, yes, adults, great. And then them going, oh, like, even for me, that scene watching Liv Tyler try and seduce Rex Manning, and you're like, oh, honey, baby.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Just like, put it
in
back
fairness,
on.
It's not that you were particularly in favor of it when you were younger as well, because it's clearly not a good idea, but it's just a bit more, oh, sweetie.
Make it end.
Yeah.
It's funny. I also watched it, really got reminded of the Jesse Spano, I'm so excited energy.
The speed freak. Yeah.
Like,
she's on caffeine pills, isn't she?
Yeah, exactly. They kept it a little bit more after school special on Saved by the Bell, but yeah, very much that's like that. That was a 90s girl, like the eager academic who was just bringing that energy all the time.
Yeah, Saved by the Bell. Wow.
Mm.
It actually did give that kind of energy as well.
Yeah, I think the thing about Saved by the Bell is it's very technical, because even in the credits you have, you know, all the kind of graphics stuff and whatever, and it feels like that inspires the palette, whereas obviously I think with Empire Records it is closer to it. It's closer to grunge, and you even have, obviously, like, in the short skirts, but you have, like, the kilts and you have the mohair sweater, and then you have, like, what they're all wearing isn't quite that, like, heightened day glow thing. It is more like the indie, and even, like, AJ and Burko with his arms out. Apparently they bought that shirt and he put it on. He's like, well, obviously you're going to rip the arms off. And it was an extremely expensive shirt. But he was correct. It is what that character would have been wearing. And then I suppose the other iconic outfit is, that's probably worth mentioning, is when Renee Zellweger is wearing only the orange Music Town apron and nothing else. And much to the delight of Warren, the underage teen shoplifter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is to counter the no skimpy outfits rule. Yeah.
So they're given as part of the Music Town storyline that is not often referred to, is they're given contracts of behaviour, and it's something that unites the antagonists of Robin Tunney, who's playing Deb, and of Renee Zellweger, who's playing Gina, because it's that you can't have visible tattoos and you can't wear skimpy outfits.
Mm. I wonder how they'll deal with the shaved head situation.
Yeah, no, I think it just didn't occur to them.
Not listed.
The shaved head situation, when she came on the screen, walked into the toilet and got the razor out, I was like, no, it's going to be Sinead O'Connor and not the Cranberries. But I got there.
You got it. So will we dive into my little segment? What's in the box? Yes, it's what's in the box.
Hey.
So for this one, I actually brought three different items because they're all kind of within a theme, but...
It's your segment, David. You can do whatever you like.
I just like to clarify. So the three items I have here are the first single I ever bought, the first album I ever bought, and the first vinyl record I ever bought.
Am I supposed to guess what they are?
Well, no, I will run through them there. So, first single was Santana featuring Rob Thomas, Smooth.
Our friend of pod, Sarah Griffin, now has a tattoo of that on her leg.
I cannot believe that.
Not of that specific artwork, but yes.
What a spectacular single, the first, can we just say.
Album I bought was U2's All That You Can't Leave Behind.
That's a great album, I'm sorry.
David, how much better is this going to get?
And then, slightly more obscure, the first vinyl record I ever bought was the single of the Sound of Ara's first single, Into the Clouds.
I don't even know what that is, so I assume it's cool.
They're a Swedish dream pop band.
Of course they are.
Yeah. That was, given the theme of the movie, I decided to dabble back into my own record collection. And Graham, I know someone with an ample record collection as well, given our co-DJing over the
years. I'm not sure you're getting back that single of something.
No.
He's got it in his clutches.
So can you remember, of the three we have here, at first of your own, do you remember singles, albums, records?
The format you're missing there, which I love, is a cassette tape.
Oh, yeah.
My first ever cassette was Back for Good by Take That.
Classic.
Yeah. My first CD was Stankonia by Outkast.
Oh, that's very cool. That's very irritatingly cool.
And my mum nearly didn't let me buy it, but just about.
Did it have the explicit sounded. Lyrics on the sticker?
Yeah, the parental advisory.
Yeah, that was it.
And then the first record I bought, which is so weird, is Mimu Hair by Nicholas Jarre.
Oh,
because it was a double A side, and both of the songs were so good. And I was just getting into records when I heard that, and that was it. So it's actually way better than it should be.
Yeah, you've got good combo between Kay. Can you remember your
first early? Album was definitely What's the Story, Morning Glory, Oasis.
Yeah,
Now I think that was gifted rather than bought, but I'm not sure I can separate. I mean, when you're like 12,
yeah, you're not buying it anyway.
It definitely wasn't the first single, but I definitely have Aerosmith, Don't Want to Miss a Thing. The single.
Love appropriate.
Liv Tyler is getting a lot of love.
Yeah, I mean.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, she's great. I don't think it was the first, but I think anything before that. And vinyl is hard to say because I definitely inherited stuff that like my dad had duplicates of and things like that. Yeah. So I'm not entirely sure about the first one that I bought. Like, I think I definitely had a copy of Carole King Tapestry. And also, like, by the time I moved, I'm trying to think when I got a record player, because like I moved out when I was 23, but I don't think I bought a record player till I had my own house when I was 31, maybe. Right. Did I buy it before that? So I did have like records, but without the means to play them.
For 12 inch artwork,
Have also have been, well, I didn't bring them, they were like in my parents' house. So I went to see Bright Eyes with my cousin Susan, who also showed me Empire Records for the first time. Very cool. Susan. She's a listener of the pod. And we went to see Bright Eyes in the Borg Gash, and he had little-known artist Phoebe Bridgers supporting him.
Oh, wow.
And I bought her EP on vinyl.
Very nice.
That is cool.
Which I do have, yeah. So
might have to look that one up on Discog, Kate, and see how much you're sitting on there.
This is your
easy,
department.
David.
This is your department, David. So you'll have to consult my manager over there.
I think I have a copy of Blonde of yours to sell as well, Graham. Frank Ocean one.
Yeah, I think now is time.
Yeah.
First gig in 7 years.
Jump on that Coachella bus.
Let's jump on it.
Yeah, she's never even thought about that. But this pay for the wedding?
Oh, that's
Yeah.
Because it's funny you mentioned as well about the gifting, because I do know that one of my earlier CDs that I owned than you two, which was gifted to me, I think it was a Christmas gift, was Dustin the Turkey's Unplucked.
We definitely had that in our house, yes.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
And then on the cassette world, I don't remember, like, I remember having a Action Man cassette box. Like, do you remember those, like, cassette storage cases that you had all the little grooves?
Like, army kind of...
It was just like...
Yeah, but they were like long and narrow. We definitely, again, was my dad's a big musician. Like we had a couple of them at home. They're almost like briefcases.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a little, like it was a briefcase. Like,
we're both holding our imaginary briefcases listeners in this like, audio medium. Like, love businessmen.
Yeah. Everyone put up your hands.
But it was just this massive big like, or it was actually, or G.I. Joe it might have been. It was just this big cartoon, big fuck off image on the cover, just like rah, G.I. Joe manly cassettes, and then you opened it up and it was like ABC time with David.
Yeah, we were big audiobooks, I suppose, as they would have been before. Oh, then nice, so we had the Giraffe, the Pelly and Me, the Roald Dahl one, so that was all frequently brought out. But yeah, a lot of tapes like would have been, you know, Tom Paxton and stuff like that of my dad's. And actually probably the tape that I've probably worn out the most listening to is Simon and Garfunkel's Live at Central Park, which is a truly great live album. And yeah, it also has a extra verse in The Boxer, which I think is only on that. I don't think they sing it normally, which I do know now, and I used to sing it when... So my dad's family are all, my mother's family, not so much, no offence, O'Connell's. My dad's family are really good, a lot of them are really good singers. And when my grandmother was still alive, she would threaten to expire if we didn't sing at like family occasions. I cannot sing at all, but my sisters won't. So I would usually end up doing it. So I would,
I volunteer as tribute. Moment.
Yeah, basically. Until I realised if I went and did the washing up with my granddad, that was the way, under the...
Absolve your singing needs.
But then again, on the other hand, like I was at a hen on Saturday and I accidentally joined a sing song with the locals. And again, I cannot sing, but it does not stop me trying, which is simultaneously possibly my best and worst trait. Yeah.
Oh, love it. So will we wrap up then with our usual final question? Obviously, this is the last one to see, and we specialize in the movies that you think everyone else has seen already.
Yes.
But is there any movie, Graham, that you feel like the world needs to see more?
This came to me straight away, and it was released a year after this, Empire Records. So I don't know if either of you two have seen it. It's called Freeway. It has Reese Witherspoon
and Kiefer Sutherland. It's mental.
It's mental and amazing. So Oliver Stone produced it, and I don't know how it was shot, but anyway, VHS quality is what I've seen. It looks like someone put a shit Instagram filter over VHS quality. You know the way The Matrix is just green?
Yeah.
But it actually gives it a style where I'm like, I want to see The Matrix as it's green. Yeah. Like Freeway is kind of actually like this cover. It's kind of pinky purple. And it's like a really dark Little Red Riding Hood type story. But Reese Witherspoon is so funny. Yeah. It's just, it's an amazing story with really dark themes about like a lot of sexual abuse and violence, domestic abuse. She's running away, she's quite poor, and this guy tries to take advantage of her. So it's kind of like a little revenge flick in a way.
Yeah.
But it is amazing.
And yeah, there's something as well about it that's so movies that only could have been made in the 90s, like Empire Records.
Yeah.
With women that went on to be huge stars.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It deals with those topics really well for something like the era didn't really deal with those topics particularly well.
No, yeah, women tended to get a pretty rough time in the 90s.
What about you, David?
So I'm going to recommend one that I haven't seen in full myself. I've seen like parts of it, and I definitely want to get around to watching the full thing. In the movie, obviously, there's the daydream sequence, Kate, you mentioned earlier, where he goes into the music video of a band called Gwar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which there's a documentary that came out in 2021 called This Is Gwar, which is all about this band who, the closest thing I can describe them to is if you know Eurovision, Lordi, that band who won a couple of years ago. Yes, yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yes.
Or no, Norwegian. Hitari were the Icelandic one who were all like BDSM. Norwegian was Lordi. But yeah.
Norwegian was Lordi.
Norwegian they were. But Gwar was the American band, and they went with the whole thing of like prosthetics and like full characters on stage, and it was very...
And they blur out his penis in the Empire Records.
Yeah, it's very politely censored. But the... their whole thing was really just to go against like the conservative... as you mentioned, the kind of parental advisory explicit lyrics, like they wanted to go all in on that and like really just be as corrupt and mental as possible. But from what I've seen from the movie, it's a very interesting story about a band that just looks like they were chaos.
And they actually, so that bit, so Mark, as we said, is watching a Gwar video and then sees himself in the television that was actually filmed at a Gwar concert.
Oh,
no way.
It did happen. The thing about this, there's all these like little kind of moments and like flights of fancy that you think are kind of something, but then often aren't.
Mm.
So yeah, I think that's kind of one of the peak ones. I'm going to go for one I think that is also a bit of a soundtrack in search of a film, and that's Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. Sorry, David just made a sound as if he had been stabbed.
I also was thinking about that film recently.
I think High Fidelity.
You haven't seen that?
Yeah. No.
Please calm down. I'm worried about you. Stop. Breathe, David. I was kind of originally thinking High Fidelity, but that almost seems a little bit of a too literal bedfellow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also is arguably not underseen. I think most men have seen High
More
Fidelity.
More than Empire Records.
Yeah.
No?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Answers on a postcard, listeners. So yeah, this is a film from 2008 starring my gal and yours, Kat Dennings, mm-hmm. and the internet's erstwhile boyfriend, Michael Cera. And it is very much set in, so like with the soundtrack, we're talking Vampire Weekend, Devendra Benhart, the dead 60s, who once asked me to go to an after party when they were supporting the Thrills. And if that's not a sentence that is of a time, I don't know what it is. And yeah, We Are Scientists as well, that great song, mm-hmm. After Hours. So, and actually, funnily enough, that's great in the film, and I don't think it is on the soundtrack, as has happened a lot with Empire Records. So basically, Michael Cera makes mixtapes for the girl he is dating, Fliss, who treats him like shit and dumps him and whatever, and has been, and she, whenever she gets them, she discards them, and Kat Dennings has been picking them up and is basically already half in love with them. So they sort of end up on a kind of, Kat Dennings has a Renee Zellweger-esque friend, only old enough to, well, actually not old enough to legally drink, but is certainly legally drinking. That is also one thing that's worth noting about Empire Records is the studio insisted on a PG-13 rating. So I think that does actually, whereas they were looking for an R. The drug use is kind of, like, you know, you don't really...
It's not very implicit, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like they... You know, there isn't, other than like, yeah, he is drinking beer at the start of it or whatever, but like any of the more substance-based activities that these people might be engaging on aren't really mentioned, like, because Eddie definitely is meant to be like a stoner. So then she has a friend who she goes out with, who's an absolute liability.
Yeah, played by Ari Grainer, who I haven't seen, she was in that one, For a Good Time Call.
Yes,
It as well. And but like gives an incredible comedic performance in this. Like, she's one of my highlights of the movie, actually.
And the main impetus for this trip, they end up going all over New York, is that this girl, when she's drunk, likes to throw up in the same places she returns to. So she's looking for her friend, accompanied by Michael Cera, and also that her father owns Electric Lady Studios, because they keep turning up at places and people can go, hey, go straight in or whatever. And then it turns out that like her father is basically like a famous music man. And then you also have Michael Cera's gay friend and his
queer punk band.
Yeah, and then he's also hooks up with some guy called Gabriel, who literally looks like a medieval angel. Yeah. So you have this kind of cast of characters.
This sounds great.
Yeah, no, it is.
And
really
great cameos in it. You've got Devendra Bernhard, John Cho, Seth Meyers, Andy Samberg, like loads of those kind of comedy ones. And
it's just massively something that's of a time, and of a time that I think we've touched on multiple times on this podcast. Like, if you went to Antics, you should watch this film, basically. Yeah. Like, and it is kind of peak 2008, and it is also one of the best explanations of my favourite Beatles song is I Want to Hold Your Hand. And when they talk about it in the film, when you're like, that's all it's about, is finding somebody who wants to hold your hand.
Aww.
And I'll hold your hand any day, David.
Thanks.
But yeah, so that's my recommendation. You're very intrigued by it, which I approve of.
Yes.
I'm going to say, because obviously we went into this movie where Cera had told you that, given your personality, she was surprised that you haven't seen Empire Records. But
yeah.
I think there's something about Nick and Nora's where, because it's more centered on the kind of bloghouse era.
That's
of
more
like,
my late era.
It was also the time we would have all lived through, as opposed to Empire Records, which was probably the time we wish we did.
Yeah. Exactly. That we looked at the adulthood from a much younger lens. For
and
that
maybe kind of, Nick and Nora will become something that, like, people who are, you know, young in this generation look back on as a kind of particular time. I think it was moderately successful. I don't necessarily think it's got a cult following.
I don't think enough people know about it for sure. I think that I would highly recommend a revisit on that one.
It's definitely of a time. It's a sort of, it's less of a kind of bottle episode feeling than Empire Records, because obviously there's only like, what, three or four scenes that are like outside of the record store, whereas this, they do go kind of all over New York to clubs and bars and house parties and convenience stores and weird, sexy parking lot dances at one point in front of a chain link fence. And then also, these are, it's funny as well. And maybe it is this idea of maybe that's what they do in America, but these are kids who are in high school as well. So you're like, how are you doing this?
I always feel people who are like live in New York or New York adjacent always seem to have much older lives than they are. these advanced American kids.
Exactly. Well, I think that pretty much brings us to a summary of Empire Records. We might damn the film, but we love the Empire.
We do love the Empire. I want to be there. I will buy a VHS and put it on in the background on my Saturdays.
Yeah, we need like one of those projectors where you can just like put a wall in your house and it can be like your window into Empire Records.
Yeah, my Empire Records loop.
Yeah.
And Graham, where can people find you on the internet and on the airwaves?
On the internet at Graham Smith with a Y DJ, and then on the airwaves. So I'm on with Jennifer Zamparelli from 9 till midday on 2FM most days, just talking nonsense. And then I'd be on later at night covering the likes of Jenny Green. And then I guess my big gig coming up, I can't talk about a few of them, but I can talk about a really fun one. I'm playing Kaleidoscope, which is a family festival in Wicklow, and I'm doing a set called The Graham Smith Super Tuniverse Disco Trip.
Elaborate, please.
Does it feature large fish or?
It's the other type of tune.
Okay, just checking.
So I did a Disney disco set last year at a festival, and I wanted to make that into more general in terms of cartoons and other animated films. And Kaleidoscope said, well, superheroes are our theme this year. So can you incorporate superheroes as well as other animated films? So I've made and found a load of different disco and house edits of music that's been in a load of different types of animated films and TV shows.
The Super Ted theme tune?
I don't have that yet.
It's a banger, just saying.
But Kate, if you buy a ticket, I'll make that up for you.
Because I don't have any kids, would it be weird?
Possibly.
Yeah, me and the cat in the front row giving it sucks.
If you bring the cat, it's fine.
I'll give you a copy of my Mickey Mouse Disco Vinyl. It was like an album they put out in, I think it was the 70s.
Yeah, and Fatboy Slim sampled some of that. And it's actually on, it's either on Praise You or the other one, what's the...
Right About Now.
Gangster Trippin'.
Oh, yeah.
It's on either one of them.
That they use a sample from the Mickey Mouse Disco.
Yeah.
Unreal. Well, now you know.
We've gone very deep into a very, very specific nugget. David, where can people find you on the internet and any live performances you may be doing?
Well, I'm at David P. Fitz, but the only live performance that I have coming up is a wedding that I'm DJing at the end of May. So it's kind of an invite only situation.
Yeah. I'm sorry, if you're not on the guest list, you're not getting in.
It's really expensive. Hey. Yeah. And Kate, where can you be found?
I'm Kate Mack on all of the things, and I tend to avoid performing publicly. Although, if you are at a sing song in the blue light, try and stop me.
Yeah, she will be there.
We need to go for a sing song.
Yeah. What will be our sing? What will be the karaoke of choice?
Kate needs to choose.
Well, there's a difference between a sing song because you need to actually know the words, and karaoke where you need to have a vague idea of the words because they'll be in front of you.
Yeah.
So for my sing song, I did Ella Fitzgerald, Every Time We Say Goodbye, because I can also fool people into thinking I'm singing when I sing it. I also did a version of Nora that my father sings to my mother, but he does a much better version, so you should get him to do it, because my father can actually sing.
Cool.
And then in terms of karaoke, that's a tough one. I really like Tracy Chapman, Give Me One Reason, because again, anything with a very low vocal range, I can sort of swag my way through it.
But I mean, if we were doing it, it would have to be like Todd Rundgren or Steven Tyler, Aerosmith, because it is Liv Tyler.
I mean, he
don't want to miss a thing, are we?
Yeah, potentially.
No, we won't be seeing it now because we won't be paying for any of the rights to use it on the episode. But like, imagine the three of these wonderful voices singing with Don't Want to Miss a Thing.
Yeah, full strings in the background.
Just have 4 minutes of silence at the end of this so they can just imagine it.
Please open your streaming app now. Lovely.
Yeah. And on that note, where can people find the podcast on the internet?
We are at The Last One to See on Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, and now on Patreon also.
We're very excited. We are going to be having our TV chat coming up shortly. So do join us for that, and then you'll be able to access all the previous Patreon content as well. So all that remains is to thank Graham for joining us. I'm sorry you didn't like the film more, but I am happy that you liked the vibe.
And I hope you like Nick and Nora's, because that's definitely on your watch list, I feel now.
It will be. And I did love the vibe. It's all about the vibes.
That's the motto of the podcast.